This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome. My name's Kathy Constable. I'm the interim director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And I'd like to welcome you all here tonight for the 12th annual William A. Nirenberg Prize for Science in the Public Interest. And we are today honoring deep sea explorer and Academy Award-winning filmmaker James Cameron. I'd like to start by taking a moment to thank the Nirenberg family for their foresight and ongoing generosity and vision makes this event possible every year. We really appreciate that. This prize was established by the Nirenberg family, and it's named in honor of the late Bill Nirenberg, who served as director of Scripps for more than two decades. And tonight, we're very happy that we have members of the Nirenberg family here. Bill's wife, Edith, their son, Nico, Nico's wife, Carolyn, and their children, William and Anna. And I'd like to ask them to stand, and we give them a warm round of applause. So that we can thank them. It's great that we're able to be here, thanks to your generosity. And it's now my pleasure to introduce to you the UC San Diego Chancellor, Pradeep Khosla, and he's here to express his thanks and officially welcome you to our campus.
Thank you, Kathy, and welcome, everybody. What a great day. It is truly one of the, in my 10 months out here, I think this is probably one of the top three best days out here. The others were really good too, but this is the top three best. So we are here to celebrate the 12th annual Nirenberg Prize for Science in the Public Interest. It is, as you know, among the most prestigious awards that the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and UC San Diego gives to luminaries. And these are luminaries who have helped bring the adventure and excitement of science into the public spotlight. These prize winners are truly extraordinary in their fields, and I think it's safe to say that James Cameron is truly extraordinary in his field. To give you some idea, he joins the company of our very own alumnus and the person who decoded the genome, Craig Venter, who's building the Craig Venter Institute right around the corner out here. He joins newsman Walter Cronkite. I think everybody knows Walter Cronkite. He joins primatologist Jane Goodall. And as I was thinking about this evening and I was trying to figure out what is it that I can say that is common between James Cameron and myself, and it clearly is not the looks, you can tell, right? And it clearly is not the talent, because he's had so many great achievements under his belt. And as I was talking to him, I realized that we share a passion, and we share a passion for robotics. My PhD was in robotics, and James Cameron, his gift to our Scripps Institution is the lander, which is one of the robotic vehicles. And he believes that we need to explore the next frontier, and I believe the ocean is one of the next frontiers besides the brain. And the best way to explore the ocean as the next frontier is not just through ships that we traditionally use, but through autonomous vehicles, autonomous underwater vehicles. And that's what James Cameron is passionate about. And I was so happy that I found something in common with James Cameron. So when I go home and tell my wife and kids that your dad is not quite useless, there is something in common with him and a very famous person, I think I'll redeem myself a little bit. Anyway, so this prize is made possible by, as Kathy was saying, by the Nirenberg family. And it's in honor of our longest-serving director in the history of Scripps, the late physicist William Nirenberg. He served for 21 years, from 1965 to 1986. And for those of you who understand academic administration, I can tell you the half-life of a chancellor is about 5 years. Serving 21 years is truly an amazing achievement, and So anyway, so through the help of the Nirenberg family, we are celebrating the legacy of Bill Nirenberg, who was one of the leaders in science in the country. So we are grateful to the family, as Kathy was mentioning, and they have also been instrumental in building the Seaside, the Scripps Seaside Forum. And I must say, I was telling Nico right before I got here that one of my most loved breakfast places in the city, and I would say that to you too, is Caroline's. So if you have a chance to go to Caroline's, I think on a Saturday or Sunday morning when it's slightly warm, it is truly an amazing place to have breakfast and see people walk around. So with that said, let me introduce really the real guest who's going to talk a little bit more, Nico Nirenberg. Nico?
Well, thanks all for coming. This is obviously another wonderful year for the prize. It's a great honor to represent the family and to present the award, obviously, to such a great recipient. And I'd like to thank UCSD and the selection committee from Scripps Oceanography. I'm supposed to say Scripps Oceanography now. So from Scripps Oceanography for making this prize possible. I'd also like to thank the numerous people who worked very hard to put this event together. William Nirenberg was born in 1919 to immigrant parents on the Lower East Side of New York City. He was educated in the New York City public school system and received his PhD in physics in 1947 from Columbia University, where he also participated in the Manhattan Project. From 1950 to 1965, he was a professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he produced over 100 publications in theoretical and experimental areas related to low-energy nuclear physics. Subsequently, as it's been mentioned, he was longest-serving director of Scripps. He was elected to the National Academy of Science in 1971. He was also a member of the American Physical Society, the National Academy of Engineering, and the National Academy of Arts and Sciences. He served on numerous national advisory panels addressing the important science issues of the day. Across the long list of his contributions, my father made was a consistent focus on connecting science and the public interest. In creating this prize and in recognition of the breadth of his career and interests, we've gone beyond the typical boundaries of science prizes to recognize a broad range of contributions. You heard some of the names of the previous prize winners. We are here today to present James Cameron with the 2013 Nirenberg Prize for Science and Public Interest. Cameron is, of course, best known for his films, including some of my favorites, the Terminator series, which is not science, but it was in the public interest. So, Titanic and Avatar. He has received numerous accolades for that work, but today we honor him for his contributions to science. These have been very significant in technology, exploration, and communication. James Cameron's technical contributions to the field of deep sea engineering are matched by his contributions to deep sea technology and documentation. In 1999, he developed a digital 3D camera system with engineering partner Vince Pace, with whom he launched the Cameron Pace Group, a technology and services company. Additionally, he developed revolutionary fiber optic spooling mini remotely operated vehicles, and in 2001 piloted them deep inside the Titanic wreck to reveal its well-preserved and architectural elegance. In May 2002, Cameron piloted his robotic cameras inside the wreck of the DKM Bismarck at a depth of 16,000 feet for the documentary Expedition Bismarck. He's continued to evolve and improve upon these innovations for subsequent underwater documentaries. On March 26, 2012, he became the only individual in history to reach the Challenger Deep in a single-pilot vehicle and the first person in more than 50 years to descend to the deepest place on the planet in a manned submersible. Achieving a depth of 35,787 feet in the Mariana Trench, his dive was part of the Deep Sea Challenge expedition, the first scientific exploration of the Challenger Deep. He documented the expedition in stunning 3D while piloting the uniquely designed Deep Sea Challenger submersible, which he spent 7 years co-designing and building. These are the first images ever taken from that location. He's also a member of the NASA Advisory Council and is working on the project to put cameras on an upcoming manned Mars mission. He has given speeches and raised money for that mission and for a nonprofit organization lobbying for the colonization of Mars. The connections and cooperation between Scripps and Jim have been significant. In the 50s, Scripps geologist Bob Fisher first identified the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench. Scripps microbiologist Doug Bartlett was chief scientist on the Deep Sea Challenge expedition. In collaboration with this project, Bartlett and his science team obtained seawater, sediment cores, and deep sea animals using a deep sea lander system developed by Scripps development engineer Kevin Hardy. Scripps alumna Chris Simons was also a key member of Jim's team. Scripps is grateful to Jim for donating the lander system from his historic Deep Sea Challenge expedition to Scripps, which will just be an amazing thing in the future. He's also donating the prize back to Scripps to develop a new lander lab for ongoing deep sea research. The lander system and the lander lab will be used by Scripps researchers as part of the next age of deep sea exploration. As you can tell, James Cameron is a man of great courage, vision, and inspiration. He also seems pretty nice. I'd like to now direct your attention to the screen for a short video.
We humans are driven by curiosity, but we sometimes think our home world has been fully explored. But Earth is the blue planet, and satellites can't see beneath the ocean's surface. Down there is the last great frontier of our world. I've seen some pretty astonishing things in the depths. Things that fill your soul with wonder. I really got bitten by the bug of deep ocean exploration. It was adventure, it was curiosity, and it was an experience that Hollywood couldn't give me. At the core of it is this idea of going deeper and seeing what's down there.
The bots are finally going to Titanic.
Say goodbye to the surface world.
When you design technology to do something new, it's going to look strange.
This is so much like flying a helicopter.
Unbelievable.
It's about creating the technology. It's about the personal challenge of actually going into this hostile environment.
Every single dive, you're going to see something you've never seen before. And you might even see something that nobody's ever seen before.
Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench is the deepest place on Earth. 7 miles straight down. It's the last great frontier of our world.
Cousteau said it best. He said if we knew what was there, we wouldn't have to go.
In 2005, I officially pushed the button on starting the design of a full ocean depth vehicle.
You really have to have a respect for the pressure regime that we're going to. 16,300 pounds per square inch. That's like having two Humvees stacked on your thumbnail. Then multiply that over the entire surface of the vehicle, the entire surface of the sphere that you're sitting inside.
So we had to make it at least twice as strong, and it needed to be lighter, and it had to have a higher crush pressure. It's a big green vertical torpedo, and the sphere is down toward the bottom, which we call the lower pod. And the lower pod also houses the science door, the manipulator, camera boom, and the weight release mechanism that brings us back.
And we also built a lander. It's this unmanned science vehicle that basically just free falls to the bottom. Got lights and high-resolution cameras, and it can take water samples and so on. It's even got this arm that drops down with a baited trap, so it can attract all the bottom foragers from miles around.
Lander is released. On ascent. Over.
So we've discovered this diverse ecosystem living 5 miles down in the New Britain Trench.
We're eating well.
But the biggest surprise comes from the lander, when we see what was attracted to our bait.
Holy cow! Amazing! Wow!
This is really amazing. This whole trip, we've only caught a trickle of small, tiny amphipods and maybe an isopod here or there. And now we have many dozens of giant amphipods.
On one dive, the lander brings back 4 new species, previously unknown to science.
That really paid off. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I just can't believe it.
On the lander camera, it's a feeding frenzy. They're like deep sea piranha devouring that chicken.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, that is clean to the bone.
This was a full chicken. But look at this. Look at how neatly they've picked every morsel of flesh off that skeleton. Look at that.
Absolutely perfect.
I mean, that's nice work.
After all these years of thinking about it and building it, here we were, and it was really going to happen.
Steady.
Look what a little group of people with no adult supervision can do if they put their minds to it.
And release.
Challenger, I am on the bottom. Depth is 35,756 feet, and everything looks good.
Oh my God!
Exploration comes with risk, but it's a risk that's worth something.
It's that need to see what's there beyond the edge of your lights, to see the unknown for yourself. It's the force that drives all exploration, curiosity.
It is my great pleasure to present the 2013 Nuremberg Prize for Science in the Public Interest to James Cameron. There you are.
Hey, how you doing?
Kathy, you can go.
Now it's our pleasure to listen to a conversation with Jim about his passion for ocean science and adventure and his recent historic journey to the deepest place in the world. And to participate in that conversation, I would like to introduce to the stage Scripps Institution of Oceanography Distinguished Professor of Geophysics, Dr. John Orcutt, who will lead the conversation. So... just before they get started, I have to say that the Chancellor was able to find some things in common with Jim Cameron. John Orcutt can, too. He's not only a distinguished professor of geophysics, he has a early part of his career had a strong interest in submarine activities when he worked in the Navy. And his relationship with James Cameron goes back 10 years when they connected over a shared scientific interest in remotely operated vehicles and optical fiber telemetry in the oceans. So just one word, they're going to start their conversation as soon as I let them. But just to note, there won't be questions at the end, so that's a mechanism whereby we get to maximize the conversation time, and I think we're all going to enjoy it. Let's get started.
Thank you. Well, I get to answer all the or ask all the questions until Jim decides to ask questions of me.
I might have a few.
We'll have a conversation. It's a different format, but I think it will work well. And I'm just going to start off with a question about how long you've actually been associated with Scripps.
Well, Charles Kennell, who I believe was the director about 12 years ago, came to me. He says with an offer I couldn't refuse. A doubleheader to be on the Scripps Advisory Board and on the NASA Advisory Council at the same time. I signed up due to Charlie's magnetic personality, and so that began my kind of official relationship with Scripps. And then there was a period of lag in between, and then I approached Scripps a couple of years ago on this project and asked if they wanted to be science partners on it. And after the initial kind of healthy skepticism that we were actually going to do what we said we were going to do, I think Tony Haymet asked everybody to support us and look carefully at whether there was some science that we could facilitate. because it was our primary goal to create a science platform, and it was the best way to demonstrate that, even though we were out there doing essentially sea trials of a new vehicle system, was to by doing true science, and that's what we did.
Great. What actually inspired you to begin to do this particular expedition in the deepest part of the ocean?
Well, you know, I'd been doing quite a fair bit of deep diving with the Russians in the Mir vehicle system, and had been going to Titanic depth, and then when we were out in 2002 at the wreck of Bismarck, which is almost 16,000 feet, I was just sitting, you know, in the dining room on the ship with some of the engineers, and said, you know, we're only going less than half of the depth of the deepest parts of the ocean. We've built all this equipment, camera housings, lighting, even small remotely operated vehicles that are 6,000 meter rated, but what would it take to go the rest of the way? And it just started as a kind of a mental exercise. What would we do for flotation? How would we deal with the syntactic foam? What kind of pressure boundary would we do? And it started to gather momentum, and I started sketching up what such a vehicle might look like while we were right out there on the ship. And that's where I hit on the idea of the vertical form factor, so that we could actually move very quickly through the water column and spend more bottom time actually investigating. And so the idea gathered momentum over subsequent couple of expeditions. In 2005, we just decided to go for it for real. We sort of, once you have a picture of it in your mind, in my case, I think it's a kind of a curse. Once you have this picture, you have to build it to see if it'll work. And it always starts that way, you know. You know what I'm talking about. You've built a lot of gear.
It's very similar, but many of your movies certainly have ocean themes, thinking back about this. And I guess it's an interesting question to know if there's a real clear connection between your movies and the ocean engineering that you do.
Sure.
That is, do one feed the other, or...
That's a really good question, because it's one thing to fantasize about going into the deep ocean, and I certainly did that when I was a kid, and I learned to scuba dive when I was 16 back in 1970, and I was inspired by Jacques Cousteau and all of the other deep submergence programs at the time, Alvin Submersible, Man in the Sea program, Conch Shelf, all that sort of thing. I followed that all quite avidly, even wrote fiction about it. But it wasn't until I made the movie The Abyss, which was my third film as director, that we started to actually build hardware to shoot underwater. Camera housings and HMI lighting and that sort of thing, and remotely operated vehicles. And then I started to realize that, except for the pressure tolerance aspect of it, we were already dealing with all the complexities of taking electronics and control systems and so on into the water. It wasn't that big a cognitive leap to think that we could build systems that would go deeper. We'd have to learn a lot more, obviously, to do it. So when I finished The Abyss, after that I made Terminator 2, but when I finished Terminator 2, I started thinking about Titanic and thinking maybe there was a story there that could be told with a contemporary wraparound story that actually showed some of this hardware, some of this technology that can go down 2.5 miles. And it was all just a big excuse to get to go and dive the Titanic. So I got 20th Century Fox to put up I think $3 million to do an expedition out to the Titanic wreck site and film it in 35 millimeter film, you know, widescreen, for a movie, which was a pretty radical concept in its time. And it was all really just so I could go dive the ship. And then the movie was kind of, I don't want to say an afterthought, because I had said I would do it.
But it makes it possible.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, it made all the subsequent expeditions possible.
I think you've been described as an engineer is also a producer, or a producer that's an engineer, which is the most apt.
Well, you don't need a degree for either one, in the way I do it. And I've been practicing engineering without a degree for a while now. I think of myself more as a project manager. I work very well with engineers. I kind of speak the language. When it gets to the higher math, they lose me a bit. But since they're mostly doing it all with FEA and FEA programs these days, they don't do the math either. So.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No, I really enjoy small engineering projects and working with small teams, solving problems. I really enjoy the challenge. And for me, I mean, you could see there that the real accomplishment of reaching the bottom of the ocean was not something that I was doing. It wasn't the type of exploration where you're mushing a dog sled across the Antarctic or climbing a mountain. You know, it wasn't that kind of physical hardship. It was really an engineering problem and an engineering solution. So my life was in the hands of the engineering team, and I knew the sub intimately, and I knew their work intimately from the period of years where we did all the finite element analysis and computational fluid dynamics. And I really liked rolling up my sleeves and being in the room with them, because when I got in that sub and they bolted the hatch shut, I knew every part of it, and I knew how we had gotten there. And so it wasn't like I was sitting there with my knees knocking too much. Because I believed in the principles of engineering and the fact that we can anticipate these problems and we can engineer against the kinds of risks that you might imagine. I think that's an important principle, and to me that's kind of part of the achievement, I think, symbolically, is like any kind of test vehicle of any kind that's ever, whether it's aeronautic or space, it proves that engineering really works.
One thing that was always interesting to me, watching the news and so on during this period, is how you managed to keep the planning and development and construction of the Deep Sea Challenger really well kept secret. And it seems a kind of a romantic story.
Yeah. Well, and you can appreciate how hard it is to have good operational security. I didn't want to say we were going to do something we couldn't do, and it was fairly late in the project that we really had the confidence that we were going to be able to do it, as we were pressure testing. Once we pressure tested the pilot sphere, we had a pretty high confidence that we'd be able to achieve the rest of it. But so we kept the whole thing under wraps. And fortunately, we asked the researchers at Scripps to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and everybody honored that. And so we were able to get our science partners on board fairly early on, which I think was really important. Although it still turned out to be a little bit last minute in some areas, because it wasn't until I think a month before we went to sea that we decided to do our sea trials in Papua New Guinea. We had originally planned on doing them offshore in Australia, where we could get down to, I think, 5,000 meters, reasonably close to Sydney, about 50 miles offshore. But it turned out that the Tasman Sea at that time of year was very, very blown out and big sea states every single day. So we decided to move our sea trials to Papua New Guinea. And there's a place there, New Britain Island, which at that time of year the winds are blowing out of the north, and there's a trench 5 miles deep, 8,200 meters, that's only about 35 miles offshore, the deepest spot, to the south. So we knew that the sea state would be relatively benign, and we were very sea state sensitive in terms of our launch and recovery methodology. So we, at the last second, switched to there, and then it occurred to us that nobody had ever looked in the New Britain Trench. It was an 8,200-meter trench. There was no data. There was no bathymetry, except for one little swath that had been shot by a German survey ship just kind of driving over it years earlier, but a few soundings from the Australian Navy in the 60s, no samples, no imaging, nobody'd looked. And so Doug Bartlett got very excited about the idea of doing some science during what were really just our preliminary engineering tests. And so they had to mobilize weeks earlier than they planned, and the whole thing was extremely chaotic, but some of our best science results were actually from that trench, which we hadn't even been talking about. So it's a tribute, I think, to the agility of the Scripps science team that they were able to adapt and prepare for work there.
You obviously had some very good engineers. You talked about yourself as a program manager for this group. But who comprised the team, and how did you pick those people?
Yeah.
Because they obviously did a great job keeping you alive.
Well, I'm here. the lead engineer was Ron Allam, and he had worked with me on six previous expeditions, developing lighting and control systems for cameras and so on. He built pan and tilts for camera housings that went on the exterior of the Mir submersibles and the deep rovers, video systems, fiber optic systems. He'd never built a whole sub before, but he had sort of done all the different pieces of it. And I knew from experience with him at sea on six cruises that he was the kind of guy that can really make things happen and a real out-of-the-box thinker and just a superb engineer. And enough of an independent spirit that he'd be just crazy enough to take on this kind of thing. And he also holds a horizontal penetration record in cave diving in Australia for a cave system called the Cocklebitty Caves. I think it's 4 kilometers on rebreathers or something like that. So, you know, I knew that he understood the consequences of engineering it incorrectly. So he was the first guy. He worked with a very small team for a few years, developing lighting, battery, and so on, lighting systems, LEDs, that sort of thing. And then really in the last year before the expedition, so for the majority of 2011, we brought in a larger team of about 20 people. The head of all electronics for the entire program was a young engineer out of robotics in Sydney, Australia, named Nick Bingham, 26 years old, ran the whole electronics team, designed the control system architecture, the onboard computer, the battery management system, and so on. So the team skewed young. Most of the team members were not from the deep submergence world. None of them had worked on a piloted vehicle before, except for Ron, myself, and one fellow named Tim Bowman from Canada, who had actually worked with us previously on the deep rover subs when we were diving them back in 2003. So, for example, the battery management system was designed by a guy who did batteries for electric buses. So you had people from aerospace, from terrestrial robotics, and from ROVs, but not from piloted vehicle systems, deep submergence vehicle systems. And so they kind of didn't know what they didn't know. And it gave them permission to think outside the box and be very comfortable with solutions that other people in kind of engineering kind of legacy programs might not have done that. They might not have made that leap because they would have done it the way it had been done before. And this seemed like the kind of program that required that because we were going a quantum leap farther. You know, the 6,000-meter kind of barrier was kind of accepted. Not, there was no, you know, physical barrier there like a sound barrier, but it was kind of a cost sound barrier, mm-hmm. if you will, because going beyond it cost more, and you were up against the yield strength of a lot of materials and so on. And so people just kind of stopped designing stuff for depths below 6,000 meters. So we had to start from scratch on almost everything, all of our electronics, all of our thrusters, cameras, lights, the syntactic foam itself that the vehicle was built out of, these all had to be created from scratch. So it seemed like it wanted to be that kind of team, you know, and that really paid off for us. And just one last thing in this answer, it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I do want to pay homage to the team. I told them all that I wanted the people who built the sub to operate the sub. So we had all these guys, most of whom had never been at sea before. You know, and I said, I don't care if you're puking over the railing for 3 weeks straight. You're going to sea. You're going to operate the sub there. Because I didn't know how anybody else could come in as an operational team and take over from them and know the sub as intimately. So they all had to learn to work safely offshore, and we put them through a training program to do that. But the same team that built it operated it, and they did a spectacular job. They all stepped up to the challenge.
I'm a Navy submariner before I started doing this work, and have dived in Alvin a few times looking for black smokers with Bob Ballard and stuff. But in the Navy, it was a common thing to say that you patrol for months of boring work punctuated by moments of terror.
Yeah.
And
that's deep diving.
When I think about the submarine that you built from scratch, basically, and with very, very good engineers, I would have been concerned, I must say, to to take away, from, leave the surface in a system like that. But it's, the design is so incredibly different as well. But was it a nice, smooth trip all these times? No special events.
Well, I did 9 dives, and they were all different. One in particular was a little bit of a nail biter. In general, every dive showed us little problems and glitches with the sub, and we'd come back and we'd reprogram, do a little bit of re-engineering on board and smooth it out, and then the next dive, that wouldn't be the problem. There'd be some other problem. And of course, the deeper we went, the more we got into pressure tolerance issues and so on. But pretty much the whole sub worked the way it was supposed to most of the time. But on my first dive going really deep, which was in the New Britain Trench, the target depth was 27,000 feet. And I knew that I was going to be diving deeper than any other piloted submersible in the world operationally right now could go, and that it would be a solo record and that sort of thing. And as I was going down, and I think I was at around 26,000 feet, things started to fail on the sub. And it was one system after another, and I was trying to chase down what was happening. And I couldn't tell if it was pressure-related or what was going on. I began to suspect that it was what they call the PAC, the control computer that all the systems ran through, that controlled everything by serial protocols out through just a small number of penetrators. And it was a little spooky because I lost my altimeter, I lost my depth gauge, I lost control of the lighting systems, I lost control of the propulsion and so on. And I was really debating if I should go on. And I, at a certain point, I wound up releasing shot ballast because I didn't know where the bottom was, and I had no way of seeing it coming, and I didn't want to crash into it. And I wound up getting myself ballasted a little bit positive. And because I'd lost control of the propulsion system, I couldn't drive down to the bottom. So I actually never saw the bottom on that dive. So I had to drop the ballast weights and come back up. And it turned out that it was one line of code that they had written the night before that I had asked them to do. So it was completely self-inflicted, because I had asked them to record the data from the touchscreen as I saw it. I wanted them to do a kind of a bitmap record, and every time it did a recording, it added some burden to this file, which just over time just got to the point that it couldn't process in real time anymore, and it shut the whole sub down. But it made me think back to a moment about a year earlier where I had insisted to the electronics guys that we not control the ballast system that allows me to come back to the surface through the PAC computer. And they wanted me to do that because it would free up penetrators going through the hull by controlling it by serial data protocol. So I said, no, I want that on its own dedicated circuit. And it's a good thing I did, too, because otherwise I'd be still sitting down there.
But it's sort of a lesson for the computer sciences majors.
That's
out
right
there,
yeah.
Probably in the back. There must be a few of them anyway. But one of the things that UCSD and certainly Scripps struggle with is finding young people that are interested in science, engineering, for education, are willing to brave that education that they have to acquire to do the kinds of things that the people you worked with do so well. And you mentioned Jacques Cousteau, and that really did, you in your case, probably me in my case. I know an awful lot of the students at Scripps came there because of Jacques Cousteau. Right. And the thing that concerns us today is the paucity of STEM education that we're getting in the country and the number of people we can effectively admit to the university and the graduate school and so on. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the kind of work you're doing provides an opportunity to push, by pushing these boundaries, to attract more young people into the fields?
I'd like to hope so. I mean, I think, the documentary, the Deep Ocean documentaries that I've made have been really geared toward that, try to make science not only interesting and visually powerful, but aspirational in the way that we show scientists on camera, in the way that they are, as as fully rounded human beings with a real passion and a real curiosity, not the typical Hollywood stereotypes of scientists who are either kind of nerdy good scientists or mustache twirling evil scientists, which is not the reality at all. And I think that, you know, kids need to see role models that make sense to them. And you know, I think that this project with this sub, yes, of course, we developed a lot of new technologies that allow us to go to Hadal depths, and I think that those will get applied to other vehicle systems, whether they be lander vehicles or AUVs or ROVs, that sort of thing. And we may even dive the sub some more. But I think the true value of what we did was inspirational, because kids just think it's really cool. And that's important. We had some elementary school kids come to view the sub, and I taught a little lesson around it. And they were only supposed to stay for an hour, and the teachers finally had to tear them away after 2 hours. And these were first and second graders. Their questions were so good. They were so lucid and perceptive. And, you know, it was 2 hours of straight questions. They just wanted to know everything about it. But you know what the one question was they never asked me? Why did you build a sub and go to the bottom of the ocean? Because for them, why wouldn't you build a sub to the bottom of the ocean? It's only when you get to be an adult that you start to question that kind of crazy idea.
I knew before that the sub was going to make a tour of the U.S. I hadn't realized until this evening that it's actually starting in Los Angeles, and I believe you're making a presentation tomorrow. So yeah. Maybe you could say a few things about...
Thanks for that. Yeah, We're going to move the sub across country, and it occurred to us at a certain point that it was an opportunity to do some STEM outreach, especially to elementary schools and even junior high and high school levels. So we've quickly cobbled this thing together in about 3 weeks. It's come together quickly. There's been a lot of support for it. So we're starting tomorrow at the California Science Center in downtown L.A., the sub will be on static display there, and we'll be there to answer questions and so on, and hopefully there'll be some city dignitaries and so on, but we don't know for sure on that. And we're going to have 22 busloads of inner city school kids come in to see it and see the presentation. And that'll be the kickoff, and then the tour will go cross country to Dallas and New Orleans, the science centers there, and then the same idea with school outreach, and then wind up in Washington, D.C. with the sub on display in front of the Capitol building and some opportunities for senators and congressmen to come out and kind of, you know, own a photo op around the ideas of STEM education, which is so critical. So hopefully this will draw attention and act as a bit of an inspirational dividend to the whole project. And then as there's a kind of a group in two RVs kind of following the sub across the country, who will be blogging and teaching as they go, one of whom is a marine biologist, a PhD from UC Santa Barbara, named Dejana Figueroa, who's now a teacher at my wife's elementary school, which is called the Muse School. So she'll be going. And also a Scripps alumnus, Dr. Christina Simons, right, exactly, who is I was talking too fast, I got ahead of my brain on that one. And Dr. Simons was our science coordinator and worked with the researchers from Scripps and also from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which that's another story about why we brought planetary scientists with us on the expedition. Maybe we can talk about that too. But she'll be there to answer questions about the science in general, some of the technology, and so on. And we'll also have one of the chief engineers on the project, Bruce Sutphen, will be there. So it should be quite interesting and hopefully inspirational.
Great. Just bringing up that issue a little more, a couple of the people you did bring along the expedition was Don Walsh.
Yeah.
And Anatoly Savelyevich.
Yeah.
And I know Don quite well. He was on the original dive to that.
Right.
And why did these folks come and the other person you mentioned from JPL?
Don Walsh obviously made a very, very similar dive in 1960 in the Trieste bathyscaphe with Jacques Piccard, who was the son of the designer of the Trieste bathyscaphe. And they dove in the Vitus Deep, which is the western basin of the Challenger Deep. And their depth and the depth that I achieved were pretty much the same within the error bar of the two sets of instruments. I dove in the eastern basin about 34 miles to the east. So we both saw different aspects of the Challenger Deep, 52 years apart. So Don was an advisor to the project from early on, and he came out and was on the ship, and he was one of the last people that I said goodbye to when I went into the sub, and when the hatch opened, he was one of the first people I saw getting out, and he shook my hand and congratulated me. And it was my hope that we could use that moment to kind of close the ellipse of history and celebrate the early pioneers of oceanography and deep exploration, at the same time advancing the cause ourselves. So it was great that Don came. You also mentioned Dr. Anatoly Sagalevich. He was the creator of the Russian Academy of Sciences Mir submersibles. Mir means peace or world. And those are two subs that I've done a tremendous amount of diving in. I've made 51 dives in the Mirs, most to depths of between 2 and 3 miles. And so it was my sort of, he was a mentor in a way, and it was my apprenticeship in the Mir subs that gave me the kind of operational knowledge to feel confident enough to build our own submersible system and manage it and operate it at sea. So it was natural for him to come out as well and be a part of it. And I think he was thrilled to be there. And then also, I mentioned earlier, Kevin Hand from Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's very interested in extremophile bacteria and chemosynthesis communities that live on these bacteria. And there are different kinds of energy sources available in the deep ocean that have nothing to do with the sun and with photosynthesis. And if you think about most of the animals that live down there in places like Challenger Deep and the New Britain Trench, they're mostly scavengers that are feeding on protein that's kind of rained out from above. So it's mostly coming from the upper water column in the photic zone. So it's really solar powered. So we were hoping to find examples of an energy source that wasn't solar powered, and one that had been proposed was serpentinization. And so if you have these deep trenches are caused by subduction, so if you have one crustal plate being dragged by the movement of the mantle underneath another one, the idea is that crustal rock that's going underneath is subjected to enormous pressure, and it forces water up, which brings chemicals up with it, and that serpentinization reaction releases hydrogen and possibly methane as well. So it could support bacterial communities. Why is this important? Well, it could be a glimpse into the way life emerged on the planet originally. It's got to be some kind of energy source that's stable over hundreds of millions of years, so you've got subduction kind of cranking away, and this doesn't require any input from the sun. So that's a possibility. It's a hypothesis that's been put forward that this might be the place that life emerged on the planet. And we actually found it on this expedition. We found the deepest bacterial mats that had ever been observed in the Sirena Deep at a depth only a couple hundred feet shallower than the deepest depth that I achieved in the Challenger Deep. So that's pretty exciting. We got a beautiful picture with our 26 megapixel camera on Kevin Hardy's lander vehicle. Kevin's here, I'm sure, somewhere. That was all done with technology mounted out of here, out of Scripps. So that photo of that bacterial mat, which we called the bearded rocks of Sirena, because it was a strange kind of pendulous bacterial formations that were unlike anything people had seen before, that was done with technology that was developed and has been now donated to Scripps. And my cash prize from the Nuremberg Prize, I also donated to that Lander Lab to continue to fund future work with that vehicle.
It's good. I was at the AGU last fall or December in San Francisco, and you talked there about your dive, and you mentioned that you could never have constructed or used the Deep Sea Challenger with government support. Were you referring to management constraints, engineering challenges, or other things?
Well, we couldn't have done it for the money that we did it for as a government program, just because of the nature of the oversight and the RFP process and everything. It just would have been done very differently. We basically were operating without any adult supervision, and we were able to move fast, make decisions in real time. And we'd have an engineering meeting every morning at 8:15 in the morning, and we just solved problems around the table. So it wasn't generating orders of magnitude more paperwork as a result of that. So we could move quickly. Moving quickly kept the cost down. We didn't relax our safety standards when it came to critical systems. We may have relaxed our mission assurance standards below what NASA might have done, for example. But we certainly never sacrificed safety, and we moved fast, and we came up with a lot of out of the box solutions. I can give you one here. At the last second, meaning a couple of weeks before we left on the expedition, we had been talking about this idea of having a soft ballast system that would inflate essentially a bag that would help assure the sub staying at the surface once it had returned in case there were any kind of buoyancy problems, and we had sort of taken it off the requirement for the vehicle. At the last second, I started thinking about a few different unpleasant scenarios, and I said, I want that soft ballast system. We're going to build it. And so with 2 weeks' warning, we built it from scratch, and it was essentially a bottle of high-pressure nitrogen that was triggered automatically by pressure as the sub descended and released on ascent when the sub came through that same triggering depth, which was at about 1,000 or 1,500 feet down. And then the gas was released. But you can appreciate that a pressure bottle pressurized to 5,000 or 6,000 psi becomes an implosion bomb at the bottom of the ocean, where the pressure might be 16,000 psi, and it could have imploded and damaged the sub. So we figured out a way to allow oil to infill into that bottle so that it became a gas over liquid reservoir. And that proved to be very safe and very reliable. But we needed a collapsible reservoir for that oil, the same size as the gas bottle. So we couldn't think of anything that was flexible and strong enough. And so we used a 2-liter Coke. I think it was a Coke Zero bottle. And it worked perfectly. It worked every single time, except on my deep dive to Challenger Deep, where the waves were so big that it broke the hatch open and deployed the bag before I started the dive, and I had the divers cut it away and remove the whole system. So it actually wasn't there when I needed it the most. But it worked flawlessly on the 8 previous dives.
I think everybody would be very interested in, and maybe you don't know the answer yourself, but it would be interesting to know what the next challenge you plan to undertake after you make another couple movies and...
Yeah, another couple movies. I'll just get that out of the way, that Avatar 2 and Avatar 3. just knock that out. Hopefully that'll provide a little money to do some more exploration. That's how I've been doing it in the past. Go make a movie every 6 or 7 years to pay for all this stuff. And then beyond that, really there's so much out there to be understood. Even at Hadal depths alone, if you take all of the area of these deep trenches all over the world and add it up, it's an area the size of North America. So there's really an unexplored continent down there. And I mean really unexplored. I mean, other than a couple places that we went in the Challenger Deep, you're talking about an unexplored continent. And no images, very few samples. A few samples may be taken by trolls, but then you've got... disintegrated animals, nothing that's been observed in situ. So there's so much work that could still be done. And whether we use the Deep Sea Challenger directly, which I'd like to do, make it part of a system of vehicles, but we need AUVs that are full ocean depth capable. We need ocean bottom seismometers so that we can study the dynamics of these subduction zones and kind of understand how we might even conceivably predict these earthquakes that cause devastating tsunamis. There's so much that we need to understand. I think people tend to think that we've kind of explored this planet and all the exploration horizons are out in space, but that's not true.
Great. Scripps has been at the forefront of studies of global climate for, yeah, for years and decades, like the iconic Keeling curve that everyone has seen, showing the continual increase in CO2 in the atmosphere, studies of atmospheric particulates and the impacts on warming, and the 3,500 autonomous Argo floats that we have in the ocean, working up and down, measuring temperature, conductivity, and so on in the oceans. What messages would you give the audience about science and the study of anthropogenic climate change, especially in the oceans?
Well, look, I mean, we could probably have a discussion just about climate for hours
for
on end.
Hour.
I've tried to
really...
We don't have that kind of time. But I think the important message is that we really need to respect science and the scientific process. And science has become politicized. And you know, I always say, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but you can't have your own facts. And the climate science, you know, the media and the way in which it's climate science has been hijacked by the political process would lead us to believe that there's controversy. There's no controversy amongst the climate science community. Planet's heating up. We're doing it. You know, it's been proved to the extent that it needs to be proved in order to inform policy. But there's a disconnect between the science community and the public. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us who respect the sciences to do our best to heal that disconnect, take science back out of the hands of the politicians, and keep the public aware and engaged, so that the policy decisions that we need to make for our own survival and for the survival of the biodiversity in this world can be made properly, because that's not what's happening right now.
Well, Jim, thanks very much. I mean, this was a great opportunity to show lots of young people, I think, in the audience, the students and so on, that science and engineering is not all dull and unrewarding by any stretch of the imagination here. So we thank you very much for taking the time to do this, and Nico Nierenberg for the presentation of the award.
Well, thanks.
And thank you all for coming this evening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.